Welcome to Artrageous, a weekly podcast about the truly outrageous stories in the art and design world.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Artrageous. I'm your host, Carrie, and I am so excited because this is our 25th full episode. I know that number might not seem very big, but it's kind of a lot when I think about all of the time and effort that I've put into making this show. I know my process isn't quite as refined as it potentially could be, but, you know, a bit of behind the scenes here, I would roughly estimate that I put in at least 5 to 10 hours each week on every single one of these episodes. And some of the earlier ones were even more. So yeah, this podcast has definitely become my baby and something that I'm feeling more and more confident about every day. So in celebration of the bread and butter type of content that this podcast thrives off of, today's topic is one that's along the lines of true crime, but a topic that I don't think I've brought to the table yet. I'm actually kind of kicking myself a bit because I completely forgot or just didn't even think of this whole side of art crime until this point. I'm talking about art forgery. I may have mentioned it very quickly in a previous episode with one of the players in an art theft, but I have yet to have an episode that was specifically about an art forger. On top of that, looking at download numbers, you guys seem to really like the bio episode on Stefan Breitweiser. So I figured let's pick a famous art forger and dig into their story. And I think you will all be pretty pleased with what I found. Or at least I hope you are, because this one is a weird case even for art forgery. So let's dive into the story of Mark Landis. As always, I like to start with a quick biography so we know at least the basic background of the people we're talking about. Sometimes those mundane beginnings make all the crazy later in the story just that much weirder. Mark Landis was born in Norfolk, Virginia in 1955. His father was a lieutenant and later lieutenant commander in the U.S. Navy. So he lived all over the world as a kid, really just moving to wherever his father was posted at the time. We're talking anywhere from the Philippines to Hong Kong, London, and even Paris. And considering I'm recording this episode while actually in Paris at the moment, I think it's safe for me to say that being surrounded by all of this amazing art and architecture is really inspiring and impactful. So that may have been a bit of an influence on him. Although we're talking about art forgery, Landis had his first taste of forging while he lived in Brussels, where he began by forging stamp cancellations for his friends. And don't worry if you don't know what those are, because I didn't either, so I looked it up for us. Stamp cancellations are marks that are applied to a postage stamp to just show that it's been used. That way, people can't just pull the stamp off of one piece of mail, apply it to another, and then mail another thing basically for free. And while it may sound weird to forge a stamp cancellation, because by nature the cancellation renders the stamp worthless for postmarking things, there is apparently value in forging them, because for collectors, some stamps are actually worth a lot more if the stamps were postally used. Rare cancellations are sometimes really highly sought after by collectors, and cancellations can also be used to prove that certain items are genuine. So there you have it, an outrageous crash course in stamp collecting for dummies like me who know absolutely nothing about stamp collecting. Anywho's my whatsits, a 13-year-old Mark Landis and his family returned to the United States in 1968 and settled down in Jackson, Mississippi. Fast forward a few years, and he later took some art courses at the Art Institute of Chicago and some at the San Francisco Art Institute. He started out studying photography, but as he says, once he learned all the processes, he couldn't think of a single thing that he wanted to take a picture of, which seems like as good of a reason as any to change course of study, which I can totally empathize with because I did almost the exact same thing when I was in college. While in San Francisco, Mark Landis also had the opportunity to learn about and work on the maintenance and restoration of old damaged paintings. I guess at that point, he considered himself a bit of an art aficionado and thought it would be a great idea to buy an art gallery. Unfortunately, he was not successful in the endeavor, and he lost money in that real estate investment. His first forgery then happened right before he returned home to live with his mother in Mississippi. He drew a version of a Maynard Dixon work and donated it to a California museum in 1985, passing it off as an original Maynard Dixon painting. Once he was back home, it was another 3 years before he donated another fake painting to a museum, this time using the story that the donation was in memory of his late father. He received a glorified thank you note, or a letter of appreciation, if you will, and showed it to his mom, who was super impressed. So this is the origin story of Mark Landis, from a kid traveling around the world with his parents to an art student and then back home with his mom. We will dig into some of those things a little bit more throughout the episode, but at this point, I can say that those first two early successes in donating forgeries was what started a 30-year career of creating pretty credible copies of various works of art and then donating them to small museums across the country. But how did he do it? How did he manage to make such convincing dupes, and how did he get the museums to accept these donations? I was so happy to find an entire documentary about Mark Landis called Art and Craft. It's about an hour and a half, and you can bet I watched every single minute of it to research for this episode. I wasn't kidding when I was telling you guys how much time I spend on these episodes each week. But this documentary starts off with a camera shot of Mark Landis walking into a Hobby Lobby, of all places. I thought it was a really odd and intriguing intro, but it made perfect sense once I realized that that was where he was buying supplies for his art forgeries. A Hobby Lobby. I mean, I guess a modern day art forger has to get their supplies from somewhere, but I was just not expecting that one. And not to get off on a tangent too soon, but I'm just going to do it. I think I might have touched on this somewhere in a previous episode, but there are a lot of really sciencey ways to determine if a painting is fake or not. This is a modern day case, so it's not like this was happening 100 years ago when it was a lot harder to spot fakes. Today, we can actually sample materials used in a painting and analyze them to detect forgeries. So if a painting is said to be created in X year, but it contains a type of paint, like acrylic paints from Hobby Lobby, that clearly weren't created until many, many, many years later, then it's pretty likely that the painting is a fake. But I'm getting ahead of myself in this story, though, so let's put a pin in that little caveat with the whole how to get away with art forgery topic and look at how Mark Landis was so successful with what he was doing. To create the different works of art, Landis would source his materials from an art store like Hobby Lobby and then go back to his house, where he would sit for hours creating the incredibly convincing replicas of works found in either museum catalogs or on the internet, but most usually it was those museum catalogs. He would literally have the original right next to him and then copy it to a T. A lot of times it was almost impossible to tell the real from the fake just by looking at it, especially once the fake wasn't sitting right next to the original. In the documentary, he literally had tables in his house just covered with stacks of his fake art and the art catalogs that they were created from. But it was really interesting to see how he worked and the environment he was forging all of these paintings in. The documentary also showed how Landis made some of his drawings, where he wasn't necessarily tracing the works that he was copying because he couldn't see through the paper, but he would put the paper kind of over the original in the catalog and just flip back and forth between the paper he was drawing on and the original super quickly and transfer what he was seeing onto the paper. I have never seen anything like it, but according to him, he's been doing it since he was a kid. When he was like 8 years old, his dad would take him to museums and they would come back with these catalogs. Then when his parents went out at night and left him in the hotel room, they didn't have a TV, so he would occupy himself with copying images from catalogs using this self-discovered memory trick, as he calls it. He also used photocopies to recreate things as well. He would take a photo of the item he wanted to reproduce, make a photocopy of it, and glue it onto a board that he had cut to size at the Lowe's up the street. After that, it was just a matter of scuffing it up and painting over top of it to make it look more like the real painting. So just like the original artist, Landis would use a variety of techniques and media to make the works that he would later donate to museums. Like he says in the documentary, heaven only knows how the artist painted it, but they aren't going to know either, which is honestly absolutely hilarious. Other things he looked at were things like auction listings and labels that had the details of the original work. And you would think that if a piece was listed as a chalk drawing, he would use chalk to recreate it. But no. Since all he was really going for was to get it to look the same, he would use whatever material he wanted to, like colored pencils, to replicate that work, regardless of how the original was created. Because in the end, all that mattered was that it looked enough like the original piece to the point where most people couldn't tell the difference. But some of these paintings are like super old, right? And keep in mind, not all of them were old. Landis would do everything from 19th century paintings to Charles Schulz Peanuts drawings. Truly incredible the breadth of work he would recreate. But some of these were supposed to be really old. So how did he make these fresh paintings look like they're from when he says they're from? The answer was coffee. Yes, he would literally use coffee and everyday stuff to make the art look like it was the original. And the frames? Those were from just any old store. Hobby Lobby, Walmart, you name it. I would imagine that a thrift store would be a good place to get crusty, dusty old frames, but if they were new frames from Walmart, he would just beat them up a little, maybe go over them with some arts and crafts stuff a bit to weather them and make them look legitimate, kind of like the piece had been in that frame for years and years and years. To make these art pieces extra convincing, he also had to come up with a way to prove what we call the provenance of the art, or its origin and history. How did he acquire a piece? Was it acquired legitimately? What was the ownership history that traces it back to the original artist? Basically, he needed documentation and paper trails to prove that this fake was legitimate. He couldn't just rely on it looking legitimate. So he would create fake documentation like auction records, bills of sale, certificates and signatures, and all kinds of things that someone would expect to be present when acquiring a piece of art, even through a donation situation. Once Mark Landis had the fake work completed, the next step was then to donate it to his museum of choice. Creating the fake works the way he did was one thing. Even creating the fake documentation and then fabricating a story in his head of how he got the art piece, that all sounded relatively easy since it was all in the comfort of his own home. But going out and interacting with people and closing the deal is a totally different challenge. I'm sure all my fellow introverts can sympathize with how difficult it is to go and talk to people sometimes, especially if you're like Mark Landis and you're a very strange, soft-spoken, timid, and just all-around odd person. And I'm not saying that to be mean. I'm just trying to paint a picture of Landis so you know that we aren't dealing with someone who is so personable that donating a real fake piece of art to a museum is as easy as eating their morning bagel. Landis's personality and mannerisms make these donations all that more intriguing. Here's a bit from an ABC News interview. It's from like 7 years ago, but it kind of gives you a glimpse of what I'm talking about.
And you were a master of disguise.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Well,
Yeah. No, I did have the idea to be a Jesuit priest. Yeah.
Is there a trick? You have to pick somebody that's super obscure, but also interesting?
No. First of all, what's most important is to find something that's not too hard to do, something that one of your children can do, and then you varnish it and bang it up some and throw some instant coffee on the back and you're all done.
And trust me when I say that the awkward nature of his speech and mannerisms is even more pronounced in the documentary footage. I would definitely encourage you to take a look at that one sometime because it is definitely worth the watch. But what I'll say in this episode is that Mark Landis had multiple different stories and at least 4 different identities that he would use to donate these works. The 2 most notable and intriguing stories, as the title of this episode suggests, was how Landis posed as a Jesuit priest named either Father Arthur Scott or Father James Brantley, He made himself out to be a philanthropist that wanted to donate works to these museums that had been left to him from either his late father, his late mother, or his sister. Well, spoiler alert, there was no sister. An incredibly interesting side note about the priest thing is that sometimes when he was wearing that costume, people would approach him and ask him for help, and he would actually do what he could to help these people out. One of the articles I read said that he once spent a couple hours in a bus station just sitting there watching over some bags of a destitute Mexican couple who had errands to run. Another example is the time when a woman approached him asking him for marriage advice. And this one's hilarious because he gave her advice that he had read in a cookbook he found in his mom's possession called Cupid's Book, which, if you aren't familiar with it, it's basically a book with recipes and kind of like a manual for manners and table etiquette for newlyweds. At the end of these kinds of encounters, he would wave one hand and say Pax Vobiscum, which I learned is kind of a salutation in Catholic Mass and a couple other denominations. So yeah, all around, Mark Landis posing as a priest was a very interesting element to this story, to say the least. Looking at some of the stories that he told all of these different museums, it is amazing that he somehow didn't get all these stories mixed up. And maybe he did slip up here and there, I don't know, but they all differed, even if it was just by the name he was going by. One example I'm thinking of is his story to the director of the Hilliard Museum in Louisiana. In that instance, he had a piece with an auction record that showed a selling price of somewhere close to $100,000 for this piece that his late mother had purchased from an anonymous seller at an auction. With this story, he implied that there was a lot of money within the family, and he framed the situation as his sister Emily was in Paris settling the family estate, and he was helping out by donating some paintings that they either didn't want to hold on to or he thought would be better suited in this museum. Landis even went so far as to mention that there were more paintings and even possible endowments from the family's estate that he would also be willing to donate. Which, for a museum, that is definitely going to pique their interest and make them lean in a little bit more to this web of lies that Mark Landis was weaving. The way that Landis was able to do all of this is just so bizarre and fascinating that I can't get over this story and the enigma that is, well, Mark Landis, especially when watching videos of him talking about all this stuff. Landis is intriguing in a kind of odd way that just captivates people and is so dang fascinating. But if we know all of these crazy details about how Mark Landis managed to forge and donate all of these works of art, it only makes sense that there had to be a point where he got caught. We just know way too much for this to still be an ongoing thing. We'll talk more about that when we return. Welcome back, everyone. Before that quick break, we talked about the crazy backstory behind Mark Landis and how he forged all kinds of works of art and then posed as a Jesuit priest to donate them to various museums across the country. Since we know all these details, it is definitely safe to assume that this is not still happening today. So how did Mark Landis get caught? As a Cincinnati, Ohio girl, I found it so funny that the guy who eventually caught on to Mark Landis was at one point the chief registrar for the Cincinnati Art Museum. When Matthew Leiniger originally met Landis in 2008, he was the registrar at the Oklahoma City Museum of Art. Like usual, Mark Landis had shown up under the premise of donating some works of art. There was a watercolor painting by Signac, or claimed to be by Signac, plus a few others. But when Leiniger did his due diligence and looked up the painting, he saw that this painting also appeared in a press release from the Savannah College of Art and Design. It looked like the exact same painting had also been donated to the college along with various other works, all donated by none other than Mark Landis. Looking into it more, there were a lot of other duplicate works showing up in various press releases from museums. One specific example was a work that was claimed to be an Alfred Jacob Miller piece that was listed in literally 6 or 7 different museums. The same piece of art cannot be in different places at the same time, so something was just a little bit off. To top it all off, Leniger also found out that the proven original for the Signac painting that he had was confirmed to be in the collection at the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg, Russia. Literally, the original was in the second largest museum all the way around the world. What Leniger was beginning to realize was that Mark Landis had created several of the same work and donated it in various places, all under various other aliases. This was the start of a big cat and mouse game between Leniger and Landis that would go on for years. Once he was sure of what he was noticing, Leniger sent out some emails to different museums and institutions, and within an hour, his phone was ringing off the hook, and his email inbox was filling up with responses. By talking to people, he was able to ask what piece one place had and confirm that the same piece was somehow also at another place. At first, people didn't believe him. I mean, who would think that something like this could even happen? It took repeated conversations for Leniger to get people to buy into what he was trying to warn them of. And lucky for us, I was able to find a more specific number to try to quantify just how prolific Mark Landis was with what he was doing. Mark Landis donated more than 100 works of art to about 46 museums in 20 different states. That is insane. We're talking about some pretty big name places, from the Art Institute of Chicago all the way to the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C. Eventually, an expose was published in the Art newspaper and the Financial Times in 2010. You would think that that would be enough to get the word out there and put an end to Landis's ploy, but nope. Even 4 years after that, with the release of the Art and Craft documentary that Landis participated in, he was still undeterred and attempted to donate dozens more forgeries despite all of this media exposure. Leniger was convinced that Landis wasn't going to stop, and he wanted to get the truth out about him, even going so far as to get Landis put in prison for his actions. So Leniger called the FBI, where he spoke to the senior investigator for the art crimes team. But the senior investigator couldn't find an actual crime. Landis had never received payment for any of the pieces and had never tried to claim any of the donation on his taxes, so there really wasn't a specific thing that they could uncover as illegal and pin on him. Even if the people running the museums had taken Landis out to a nice dinner or gave him some VIP treatment as a result of those donations, then that's not really a federal offense, and that's on them. At the end of the day, all the FBI could uncover was a man who was going around the country on his own dime giving free stuff to museums. And to be fair, Leniger wasn't the only person that was suspicious of Mark Landis. It's not like Leniger was the only person red-pilled and everyone else was happily sitting around with rose-colored glasses completely unaware of these donations. There were certainly other museums that were a little suspicious and kind of caught on to what was happening. Thinking back to my comment earlier about how there are ways to test fakes, there was one gallery director who sort of had the same idea. After receiving a painting in a donation from Father Arthur Scott, who we know as Mark Landis, the museum director remembered receiving an email about a man dressed as a Jesuit priest giving art donations to museums. So the museum's director decided to ask the museum's registrar, named Joyce Penn, to take a look at the painting. In a pretty simple test to see what's going on the surface of the painting, Penn decided to use a black light to look at the surface of the painting. Anywhere there wasn't paint started glowing white, which should not happen on a legitimate painting. She also remembered that the paint smelled fresh, and that was definitely not normal. She then looked at the painting under a microscope, and she could actually see the dot matrix from the printing on the photocopy paper, which clearly would not have existed in the original and accounted for that glowing under the blacklight as it interacted with the digital reproduction underneath. Although the painting was good enough to fool the museum director who had accepted the donation, it started to look pretty sketchy after a more thorough analysis. After connecting the dots between this instance and the stories they had heard, they somehow found out and got in contact with our friend Matthew Leininger, who by this point had an oil-on-panel piece by Stanislaw Lapine that had been acquired under similar circumstances from Mark Landis. He did the exact same light and microscope tests, and I'm sure you can guess what he saw. Another perfect example of multiple different people having alarm bells ringing in their head about this whole thing would be a story from 2003, when Landis had donated art to the Loren Rogers Museum of Art in Laurel, Mississippi, which also just so happened to be the same town that his mother lived in. He had donated a painting by Everett Shin called Nymph on the Rocks, and had promised other works as well. And of course, if you offer a museum something, they're gonna follow up. So they tried to follow up for about a year, but when he didn't give them the works, they got a little suspicious. Maybe Landis was off busy fooling other galleries. Who knows the reason? But by not giving the museum the promised paintings, they got to be a little suspicious of him. The Mississippi Museum's director then heard from other museums that they too had been visited by Landis, who had also promised stuff but then ghosted them. Since the Laurel Rogers Museum of Art was in the same town that Landis lived in, they were actually able to track down Landis and confront him with the info that they believed the piece was fraudulent. At which point, Landis simply said that he wished he had known that when he bought the painting, almost like he was someone who had also been duped. And I think it's important to note that Mark Landis was successful for many years up until this point, not only because of his art skills and his ability to convincingly recreate works, but also because he was choosing to copy works by what, in movie terms, we would call B-rated artists. He wasn't copying the Mona Lisa or a Rembrandt or a Vermeer that so many people are familiar with and would instantly know that what he was trying to donate was in no way possibly the original. He would choose artists that had some kind of clout but weren't super well known enough that the museum staff would likely be familiar with the artist or their works. Another thing to consider is that if a museum is getting something for free, they're going to be a lot less scrutinizing of it than they would be if they were crossing their T's and dotting their I's on a million-dollar purchase. To go even further into that, and this is kind of odd to consider if you've never thought about it before, but in the museum world, in a donor scenario, it's mostly on the donor to vouch for a work's provenance. That's not the museum's job. Yes, they should probably do their due diligence at some point, but it's really mostly on the donor to make sure that a piece is real. Since Mark Landis had jumped over that hurdle by forging auction receipts and labels that he included with these works, many of those 46 museums in 20 different states didn't even think twice about the authenticity of these works that they were being gifted, even if the man who was donating them did seem a little bit odd. Another sidebar fun fact about the art world is that pretty much every museum has at least one fake in it, if not collectively entire rooms of them, be it on display or in storage somewhere. Think about things like reproduction furniture, old Bibles, stuff that they just can't turn down when it's brought to them by a collector who maybe discovers that they have a fake and decides that they want to shove it off to a museum for a tax benefit. Sometimes the museum knows, sometimes they don't. There's a lot of sketchy stuff that happens in the art world, and I would say that it is going to make for some great future episodes here on Artrageous. But if we are trying to figure out the why for Mark Landis's almost inexplicable reasons behind forging and everything else, there's another important biographical bit that I strategically left out earlier in the episode. The thing I left out was that when he was 17, he was deeply depressed after his father's death, and he spent 18 months in a Kansas hospital where he was diagnosed with schizophrenic, paranoia, and psychotic disorders, plus catatonic behavior. As I've said before, I'm not a psychologist, but I think we can kind of connect the dots from his childhood to how he ended up as the infamous art forger that has been talked about in publications like Art Magazine and the New York Times. I think what's really so captivating about this particular case is that Mark Landis definitely does not fit the mold or standard profile of an art forger. He wasn't looking for material gain. All of his art was donated rather than sold for money. He's also not like forgers, who we'll talk about more in the future, where he's this super bitter guy that's trying to use his forgeries to punish a world that failed to appreciate him or prove some kind of point about unrecognized talent.
The motivation for his elaborate con, not malice or greed, but loneliness.
Made me feel warm all over. I had a nervous breakdown when I was 17. I guess it was just years of watching TV, seeing philanthropists and big important people doing things.
And that's what gave
you? It was an impulse. I've always had poor self-esteem for obvious reasons. And I really did. I got treated like royalty. And listen, I liked it.
Thanks again to ABC for that audio clip. When he was talking in the documentary that I watched, I was really able to see how his mother's death impacted him and played a role in his forging and donating. He also talked about how in Sunday school, they always told kids to use their gifts. So he had an impulse of sorts in 1985 and decided that he wanted to use his gifts to be a philanthropist. Rewinding to earlier in the episode where I talked about the first time he donated a painting. The story behind that was that he had previously visited a museum in California with a Maynard Dixon exhibition. So in 1985, he drew a portrait of an Indian from a photograph in a book. It wasn't even a recreation of one of Dixon's paintings, but he still signed it with Dixon's initials. He then went to the Oakland Museum in California, where he asked to speak to the curator and give him the drawing. The guy apparently treated Landis so nicely that he became almost addicted to impersonating a philanthropist. Psychologically and scientifically speaking, to the point of why he did it, it came down to that dopamine boost from having someone appreciative of his donation, plus his mom's pride in the donation, that got him addicted to doing what he thought was a good thing. Granted, from what I read, his mother's approval didn't last all that long once he moved home and once she realized what he was up to, at which point she just kind of turned a blind eye to it. But when you combine the feel-good nature and addiction of donating this fake art with some of the diagnosed psychological things like the schizophrenia, then that kind of helps us see Mark Landis's thought process and how and why all of this happened. Interestingly, again on the psychological side of things, all of the work that he put into the art pieces was a great way to help him manage his mental illness by giving him a sense of purpose. I really don't think he ever meant any harm in what he did. In fact, I think he might have truly thought that he was doing a good thing by donating art to all of these museums. Speaking of museums, what about the dozens of art museums caught in the middle of all of this? What did they do with the art? Well, there's not much that they could do with it. The good news is they didn't pay any money for these art pieces, so I'm assuming there wasn't an outrageously large financial impact from this debacle, so that's at least a little bit of good news on their part. But of course, I'm pretty sure a lot of these museums were pretty embarrassed that they were duped so easily. It's a reputation thing. They probably think that there is no way that that can be good for their reputation. But on the flip side, they could easily display the work with a sign saying, hey, this is a replica painting created by the famous art forger Mark Landis, and it was based on the painting by so-and-so. That could be kind of cool and a fun story to tell. So I would think it would be a great way to educate people about the story and this piece of art history. Because believe it or not, Mark Landis is now officially a part of art history. And that whole display the work situation is pretty much exactly what happened in the spring of 2012. Our detective friend Matt Leiniger and Aaron Cohen, the director of the DAP Galleries at the University of Cincinnati, organized a collection of Mark Landis's work that was featured in a full-on exhibition called Faux Real in April of 2012. I personally love that this happened in Cincinnati of all places, but one of the weirdest twists of this exhibition is that Cohen persuaded Mark Landis to lend his Jesuit priest outfit for display. And that was in addition to 60 plus paintings and drawings and art books. And if that wasn't funny enough, Mark Landis was also invited as a guest of honor to the exhibition itself. Maybe that's not quite as weird as I think it is, but wouldn't that be kind of awkward? Especially if we remember everything that Leninger went through to try to get Landis put into federal prison. This interaction went something to the tune of Landis walked in, he ran into Leninger, and then pretty much wanted to leave right away because he had, quote, seen this stuff before. When Landis asked if there was anyone nice he could talk to, Leninger said, I'm nice, I'll talk with you. And then Landis basically went like, no, I just want to go back to my hotel. So Leninger shook Landis's hand and said, thank you for coming. Landis did take the opportunity to say, I'm sorry if I ever caused any trouble. I didn't think I was doing anything wrong. Just let me know if there's anything I can do to help you out. And Leninger simply said, Mark, I just want you to stop. What an interesting interaction, I guess we'll call it. I don't know. I guess when someone comes face to face with their arch nemesis after all these years, then that's probably the best we could have hoped for in that situation. Nowadays, Mark Landis is not still producing forgeries and donating them to museums. The Art and Craft documentary has brought Mark Landis's name across the country to all kinds of people's homes and has almost served as an eye-opening commentary on mental health. After finishing recording the documentary, the team set up a website for Landis where he can take commissions from people instead of making forgeries, which totally makes sense because he really does have an amazing talent that should not go to waste. And that is the story of Mark Landis, the art forger who may be the most famous art counterfeiter who never committed a crime. I guess the takeaways from this story are that forging art might not be as tricky or intricate of an affair as I previously thought it would be, and you can get away with forgery as long as you don't make any money off of it, since apparently a forgery is only a forgery if you try and sell it. Since all this art is technically more of a copy, maybe Mark Landis is more of a con man than an art forger. One more thing to think about is I think you could also look at it as his methods were just a different way of getting his works into galleries versus we had previously talked about the Banksy method of literally slipping into galleries and hanging the works on the wall himself. Even without being as brazen about it, Mark Landis is what I would call a somewhat eccentric person, and this case was still a super fun and interesting story for today's episode. And I'll admit, this was probably the most fun I've had researching in a while. There were just so many twists and turns, and just looking at the variety of art copies Landis produced, we're talking things from Dr. Seuss Cat in the Hat drawings to full-on fine art paintings. Even official documents like a treaty warrant from the treasurer of the Republic of Texas. That's a pretty big difference in a huge variety of things that Mark Landis forged. So yeah, I had a lot of fun learning about this story and telling all of you about it. If you enjoyed it too, tell your friends. Invite them to check out this cool, fun podcast that you listen to every week or even just here and there. If you have 2 seconds, please leave me a 5-star review in your podcast app. I'm really trying to grow this show so we can do more fun and cool stuff in the future, like maybe some artist interviews. But to do that, I need your help. So please leave me a 5-star review, write a review if you have time, and tell your friends and family about the show. Looking ahead to what I have in store for the next couple of weeks, I have a lot of travel scheduled, but I do still plan on putting episodes out there. By the time you listen to next week's episode, I will be in Florence, Italy, where I will be checking out the statue that just so happens to be the podcast art for this show. And soon after that, there's a trip to Venice to see what I can find there. So I'm thinking maybe I'll come up with some cool stories to lean into that experience. And then when I get back, I might have some additional ideas for fun topics. So yeah, all of that is in the works and coming your way soon. I hope you have a fantastic week, and I'll be back with another episode next Thursday. Until then, stay artrageous.
Series music created by Arensen. Music and transition sounds licensed from Motion Array. Artrageous is a proud partner of Stoveleg Media.
Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.